One of the most frustrating things about teaching classes like this is you say all this stuff that you think has to be front-loaded, has to be in the beginning of your lesson, and it sets the course and the tone for everything that follows, but people haven't come in and sat down. The alternative is, of course, just to blather for a few minutes, talk about birthdays and puppy dogs or whatever, you know. But then, if you do that enough, then people say, well, he doesn't say anything important the first few minutes he speaks anyway, so they just stay out there longer as it is. So you cannot win at this, you know. And they'll always have that effect that people say, well, that's a pretty good study. I think I'll start going to it. But they come 2 or 3 weeks into it, and you think, well, you want to go back and teach them all the stuff you started with, but they weren't around for it. This is lesson number one on It's Always Something, Problems in the New Testament Churches, and it seemed like a good approach to the Scriptures to me. When I thought about it, I mean, the Gospels themselves, of course, don't talk about church. I mean, Jesus only uses the term church a couple of times, really, in all the Gospels. I mean, the call in the Gospels is toward the individual. But when you get into the book of Acts, the church is established. And in particular, then, you get that other sweep of things that comprise the New Testament, the letters. And the letters that are going to the churches, of course, are divided different ways. There are the epistles that are addressed to churches, those that are addressed to individuals, and there are some they call the general epistles. Some people call them the Catholic epistles. They sort of, well, we're not really sure. They seem to go to several churches at once. And then you've got a few oddballs. Hebrews has always been an oddball. Some people think it might have actually been more something like a sermon that got published and circulated. It lacks some of the elements of, you know, if you want to use the big terms, the epistolary elements that you would expect to be there as to who it's being addressed to and problems in specific churches. But generally speaking, in those letters, there are a lot of problems when you look into the churches that are right there. And you soon lose that illusion that maybe because you stood closer to the time of Jesus and maybe were established and even taught by one of the apostles, that somehow or other that made for a higher class of human being and Christian. In fact, you see problems that are every bit as dramatic as anything you can read in the stories of today, you know, scandalous things that happen in churches. Well, they started early and happened often. And so you see this, and a lot of attention is given to problems. And those are problems with persons, problems generally in congregations, problems of different ways. So the question is, what do you think you're going to get out of studying the problems in the New Testament? What's to be gained? Just by saying, well, instead of starting with a doctrine or a person or some kind of issue, we're just going to go right to the problem and talk about it. What do you think we might be able to get out of that?
I'll
have
to repeat.
Well, those who don't know history are bound to repeat it. And right. And frankly, those who do know history repeat it anyway, too. So that's although there's that. Yeah, hopefully we learn. But think about it. What's that?
Some consolation that there were problems then.
Yeah, well, I think it does give us perspective, certainly. Like I said, the illusion that somehow there was a Christian church or a Christian person who was somehow better than we were, or that it was purer at that point, that falls away pretty fast. And so there is a kind of consolation in that, saying, well, there's nothing surprising about the things we face in churches, but what else might we get here? Yeah, well, why would we have a solution?
Well, you can see how they work through it.
And how did they work through it?
Teaching.
Mm. But in particular, who's teaching?
Jesus?
Well, yeah, generally, but he was in the same relation to them as he is to us, right? At the right hand of the Father. What did they have we don't have? No?
The disciples.
The apostles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what they had were apostles. We don't have those. We don't, in that sense, they do stand closer to a source of authority than we can stand. I mean, we stand in relation to the Scriptures. They had the Scriptures, but of course, these are the Scriptures. They were just being written. They stood closer to the apostles themselves. So in a sense, like even, I mean, we believe the apostles have special authority, but at the very least, even if you're a real skeptic, you say they had expert guidance, authoritative guidance. How did they address the problems? Well, then they have something we don't have, which is just a kind of authority to speak to things. So in a sense, what we stand in relation to the scriptures, they stood in relation to the apostles. One of the things that really intrigues me is that they had expert guidance, but it's not simplistic guidance. I mean, you'd say, well, then why doesn't Paul just come in and put it in order, or Peter, you know, just this is what you do, this is how it's done. You think, well, you know, it's really, they don't resort often to authoritarianism, you know, just sort of do it because I said it, and I'm Paul. Who are you? Or do it because I said it. The situations are often complex and layered, and sometimes the advice has to be kind of qualified as to how the problem should be addressed, what should be done, and what the relationship of an entire congregation to that problem ought to be. One of the things that's always fascinated me is that the New Testament, sometimes it almost seems like it's giving, I don't say contradictory advice, but advice that sort of takes a little bit of thinking. Well, how does that work? One of the passages that always, you say, it kind of amuses me comes from Galatians chapter 6, where in chapter 6, it seems like Paul says two things that are almost opposite to the congregation. And this is in light of a problem, not the problem we're going to study today, but it shows you how you have to not be simple-minded about how you're looking at how they address the problems or the kind of advice they gave to subtle problems. Now, I'm looking at Galatians chapter 6, and would somebody read chapter Galatians 6, verse 2? Galatians 6, verse 2. Anybody who gets there first.
Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ.
Right. So there's a pretty sound advice. You say, we're all in this together, we should carry one another's burdens. Now, somebody read verse 5.
Where each one should carry his own load.
It didn't hardly even take a sentence to have him say, bear one another's burden, and everybody carries their own load. Well, you know, why do I bring it up? I said, well, because it's not simplistic. Different messages sort of have to apply maybe to different people at different times, really even immediately within the situation that's at hand. I always think that's an interesting one. One of the things that church problems usually lead to are what?
Division.
Very good. Yeah, somebody else said it too. Yeah, people divide. Why do they divide when there's a problem in a congregation? And who usually divides?
They can't come to an agreement.
Yeah. But usually when it's a problem, it's very interesting, when there's a problem, so often, speaking as a pastor and just looking at church history, it's not the sinners who leave, who lead churches out in different directions, because they're sinners and they know it and they're humble about it. It's the extra righteous who divide churches. The super righteous are the most dangerous for church unity in any church history situation. It's I can't live with you because you're such a slouch. You teach wrong, you practice wrong, the church won't do anything about you, let's go out the door. That's where church division has often come from. The super righteous have driven it in some cases. The super righteous, and we'll see that actually that's going to be one of the problems we deal with here, is how to deal with that level of judgment. A confession for me as a pastor, I didn't come from a Christian world, as you know, and personal sins rarely shock me. I mean, I people say they did this or they did that, or he did that or she did that, and can you imagine? And everybody's shocked, and I'm just thinking, yeah, well, I've heard this before. You know, it's in all of us. We're sinners. You know, I'm never shocked. But where I was shocked, and it really limited me as a pastor, is how people treated one another in church. That was the one that always got me. I'd just be gobsmacked. You're kidding. That person's thinking that about the church, about other people. I'd be paralyzed. I'd be befuddled. I didn't know how to address it so often. I couldn't believe the scandalous behavior of Christian to Christian, their judgment of one another, their feeling of superiority. These kinds of things it was a real problem for me as a pastor to learn how to get past the kind of paralysis that would sit in for a couple of weeks. So I thought, I can't believe there are people doing that in the church. Not their personal sins, but the way they were treating one another. It always kind of freaked me out for some reason, behavior in the church. Well, today's lesson will touch on all these things I'm mentioning here. We're in Romans chapter 14. And we'll be taking it in two chunks. We're going to skip one verse just to kind of complete the thought that's here. The book of Romans was written to the church where? And where? What is Rome? Talk about Rome for a moment.
What's the center of power and authority?
Yeah, I mean these are some churches are. I say backwaters. You know, the real backwater church of the New Testament was what? Colossae, the Colossians. I mean, it was really an insignificant place. Although it's very interesting that Colossae was also that when we read it, these are really, really cosmic, intellectual people, and we'll get to them actually. But it wasn't a big important city. It was kind of a side story in anybody's eyes. Rome, though, is the capital city. It's New York City. It's Los Angeles. It's pick one of the big thriving cities of the world, and Rome's there. Do you know anything about the church in Rome? Well, do you know anything about the letter to the Romans? I mean, what do you think of when you think of Romans?
Doctrine.
It's very doctrinal as a book, right? I mean, it's the one that talks about, who can deliver me from the body of this death? All people are sinners. It's the one that comes into Romans 8, the glorious chapter about what can separate us from the love of Christ. It moves then into the issue of what of the Jewish nation. And then it moves into the area we'll be into today. It appears to be a layered church. And by this, I mean pagan backgrounds and Jewish backgrounds. I mean, both things seem to be under consideration there. It seems to be a church where a doctrinal foundation can be taught and needs to be taught in that context. So you picture a kind of, maybe perhaps in keeping with the fact that it's a big city, there's a kind of a layer of maybe intellectual sophistication to the church. I mean, they're capable of dealing this. I remember R.C. Sproul saying, I mean, just imagine Paul trying to go to a Christian publisher today and get the book of Romans published. I mean, they would send that thing back to him in an envelope so fast it would make your head spin, right? I mean, so, this is way over everybody's head. Nobody understands it. But clean this up. You know, give us a few anecdotes. Put a splashy cover on it. Maybe we can, do a limited edition. But it'd be a real problem, wouldn't it, publishing the book of Romans today? Because you can bog down in there. I mean, these are really deep thoughts that go by, especially if you read it in length, take it in its totality. What else to say about the book of Romans? Paul hadn't been there yet.
I was thinking about Nero took power in 54, and they're thinking this is written in 58. It would be a very unpredictable, chaotic time, unpredictable in that you don't know if you're safe, if you're going to be targeted as a believer.
Nero, he was a nice guy, wasn't he? Oh, the story, I don't know how much it gets embellished, turning his enemies into human tortures, rolling them up in rugs soaked in tar and putting them on, posts and lighting them on fire. And then, of course, the story gets even more lurid that he would, ride his chariot around unclothed, while the bodies burned around him. And, of course, the famous playing the violin while the city burns. Yeah, that old, of course, there weren't violins or anything like that. But, yeah, Nero's a nut job. He was so crazy, they thought, wasn't the idea that Nero, Rividius, what's the word, lives again? They were afraid he was going to come back from the dead and get him, you know, like Nero lives again. Like, he was horrible. Yeah, so if it's written there, most people think it's written in the late 50s, probably from Corinth. And if it's written under Nero, then, of course, Nero is going to, most people think Paul's martyred under Nero, too. Although, there's no certainty there. Paul had never been to this church, as far as we know. We don't know the history of this church, but it's the capital city. So how did the gospel get there, and how did the church start really its formation in Rome? As far as I know, nobody really claims to know a lot of it. I mean, there are obviously theories people will have, but I don't think anybody's got a real clear sense of when the gospel was taken to Rome. You can't go to the book of Acts and see its establishment the way you might the church in Thessalonica or the church in Corinth or some of the other churches in the New Testament. Well, anyway, so we get to this church, and my problem for today was weaklings. And so we have 14, chapter 14, and we want to read down through 15, and then we want to jump and do 17 through 18. So would somebody kindly read us chapter 14, 1 through 15? Okay, that's so we'll skip one verse. No real compelling need to. It's not a long verse, but to jump to another idea. But clearly, I mean, Paul's not just pontificating at random. I'll sort of just throw out some good advice there in case you happen to need it. I mean, clearly we have an issue in the church, and it apparently is divisive enough that it must be addressed here. And in verse 1, it tells you what it is. Receive the one who is weak in faith, but not to dispute over doubtful things, or however you have it worded. Actually, that one's a little tricky. I understand it in the Greek as to how they need to translate. It's a real problem with real people in a real church happening now, and he addresses it. Now, I'd like to skip, though ahead and just read 17 and 18, because it paints a picture of church the way you might say it ought to be. Would somebody read us 17 and 18? Okay, I mean, I would jump ahead to that picture of what it's supposed to be like. I mean, what has been violated in the problem? What has been lost when the problem's there? Well, a vision of church and discipleship and Christian life that's in 17 and 18. What does an authentic, you might say, ideal church consist of? And 17 tells you what, in a sense, it does consist of. What would it be and what would it not be? If church isn't merely a social organization, a human club, well then what's it look like when it's functioning right, when it's really authentically, spiritually driven by the Spirit? It's not in what? Eating and drinking. Now, we're clearly not just referring to banqueting, right? Now, we'll get to that when we go back and look at the problems here. I mean, we're talking about some kind of program of what does it mean to be righteous. We'll only get that from looking at it earlier. But we're not just talking about, this is not a condemnation of people who are gluttonous, but of people who have practiced their discipleship in a certain way. In a sense, you might say, the kingdom of God does not consist of a rigorous discipleship program with these markers. It just isn't there. But what does it have? We've got three elements there. Right, and obviously driven by the Holy Spirit. I mean, let's not mistake the idea that there's energy coming from outside of us to do this. Righteousness, peace, and joy. I wonder, could you sell your church that way? The church grows people. Come, we experience righteousness, joy, and peace. How would we sell our church? Well, it's interesting. Well, we take those three elements and say, this is the picture of church the way it ought to be, not in the rigorous program of discipleship we'll see they've created, but in righteousness. What is righteousness? We tend to think of righteousness in terms of kind of people who are almost sort of uncomfortable to be around, right? I mean, they just do everything right, and that makes them righteous. I think that's an interpretation you better get away from. Righteous people, yes, do things right, but they are always fair. They always see things right. They are just in what they do. There's nothing false in a righteous person. We know what peace is, and we know what joy are, and we know that those, if we're functioning in Christ with a real church, these should become there. Now, the idea is people practicing this are what, in verse 18? They are serving Christ, they're acceptable to God, and they are acceptable to men, you know, approved by men. So, that's what the church needs to look like. You don't need to put a layer in church of some kind of test as to whether somebody's okay with God or okay with your church witness or anything of the kind. That those people who have their minds focused as 17 and 18 would have them they're all right with God. They don't need tightened up. They don't need corrected or worked on there. So now we go back to the beginning of it, and we say, well, what are the problems in this church? Going back 14, 1 through 15 now. What's the first problem that comes up? And actually, we'll push it aside and get to the second one, but what's the first one that comes up? Okay. Except that there's somebody, you receive one who is weak in faith. Okay. All right. Now we go to verse 3 and we see, what's the first problem? What they're eating or not eating. What's this about? What's that? Well, you would think so if you were in Corinth. Because in Corinth, what's the issue? Yeah, what do you do when meat might be sold that's sacrificed to idols? What do you do if you're invited to a banquet that's probably being held in a temple? You know, what do, you know, in these kind of situations? Although it seems that in Rome, this isn't the issue, that we're actually, at this point, after we've come through a lot of stuff about Israel and Jews, we're talking about Jewish dietary restrictions in this case. What are some Jewish dietary restrictions? No pork. What else? Blood has to be extracted. You know, the blood has to be poured out in it. What else? Just for fun. Yeah. Well, tell me what's kosher. Pork isn't poorly slaughtered meat is not. No shellfish. Nothing that doesn't have fins and scales.
Don't mix dairy.
Yeah. Don't no cheeseburgers. No mice. Couldn't you have eaten mice?
The Romans ate mice.
Yeah, I know. The dormice were a big delicacy, but I'm trying to remember if, like, in Leviticus 9, are they excluded?
Aren't rodents prohibited?
Well, you had the chewing of the cud and the cloven hooves and all those things. I mean, we had all kinds of dietary restrictions, but I don't know if mice would be excluded or not.
I thought certain types of rodents were prohibited.
Maybe the rock hyrax was not allowed to be eaten. That's a rodent that lived up in the, like a squirrely kind of thing, that lives in rocks. Scary critters. I've seen them in. Well, anyway, you know the issues. Leviticus chapter 9 has a lot. Yeah, I think it's 9 has all the dietary restrictions. And principally, though, I think what do you do if you're a Jew and you aren't sure of the quality of the kosher qualities of things that are being served, sold, things like that. What do you do? What's that?
You don't eat.
Well, you have to eat. So what? You got to eat something.
The vegetables.
And we have a good example of this in the scriptures where? Daniel, right? Right. He won't eat the king's meat. He won't drink the king's wine. He'll eat vegetables, and you know that how that whole story works like that. I don't think that's an uncommon thing for Jews caught in situations in which they're not sure if they can keep kosher or not, that vegetables are pretty much universally, are universally allowable. A vegetarian diet's not going to get you into any trouble, and you can mix dairy with it, and you wouldn't necessarily, if you didn't have meat, that wouldn't be a problem. So that's a good option here. You can eat so clearly there are people in Rome thinking who are Jewish Christians now, who are continuing to keep kosher, and probably insisting what? That this really is the standard for all the believers in the church, that everybody better do this, or at least you're superior if you do this, because you're not sure of things. So what's problem number two that comes up? It shows up in verse 5. What's that? Well, is it the Sabbath? What does it say in 5 and 6?
One person considers one day to be above another. Someone else considers every day to be the same. Each one must be fully convinced in his own mind.
Yeah, now this is an intriguing one because you always assume it's the Sabbath, and it's probably not a bad bet. But we do know, for example, that the church does what to the Sabbath right away early in its history? Yeah, Sunday becomes the day of gathering, and as the church Gentilizes, of course, exactly what the restrictions are on that day are hard to measure. They don't necessarily observe it in a Jewish fashion. They gather on that morning, but the idea of restrictions on work and things like that develops in church history a little bit later, kind of a rigorous thing. If it's not referring to the Sabbath, what might it be referring to? Yeah, like what? I missed it.
Feast of Booths.
Oh, Booths, yeah. Well, you'd have three biggies, right? You'd have Pentecost, Passover, and Tabernacles. And you'd have other minor feast days. How those start to develop in Jewish history isn't real clear at this point either. I mean, whether you had Yom Kippur and some of these other things being practiced quite the same way. But in any event, it would be the program of church. Kind of, is the church obligated to continue to observe the calendar of the Jewish faith? Now, whether it would be a Sabbath or not, it's always been a big question, because wouldn't the church in Rome have already moved it to the first day of the week? Were they, in a sense, trying to transfer Jewish understandings over to the Sunday, the first day Sabbath, rather than the Jewish Sabbath? It's hard to say. But in any event, holy days are the one way or the other, you get the same issue here. Do you do it or not? Are you required? Is this required? Now, we've already learned in 17 what? That the kingdom of God is not in eating and drinking. I mean, it's not in observation here. And you can work with this way. But what's the real problem about the vegetable and holy day issue here? You have one to eat or not to eat, or to keep or not to keep the holiday. But what's the real problem? Judgment. So who's judging whom in this case? It would seem that the rigorous party was the one doing the judging. And the problem with judgment is what, when you look at this? And if you look at verse 1 and you look at... it could go either way. You're right. I mean, I don't think you could say that it's necessarily... Mm-hmm. Now, Paul does say in verse 5, let each be fully convinced in his own mind. Now, so the problem isn't so much that you can't do it, but you can't judge. But what's the issue with judgment here? What's that? Oh, heavens, yes. I mean, that's always driving kind of, you're pleased with yourself and not pleased with other people. I mean, that drives so much that goes on. This is all very interesting. By the way, it's intriguing that an earlier generation of Christians, when American Christians in particular were interested, they thought, this can't possibly be referring to the Sabbath, because that the command to keep the Lord's day is a permanent command that precedes the law. And so it's silly to think this is the Sabbath, because the Sabbath day idea of isolation is still valid, still for Christians. A modern American Christian in our world, probably just it's very foreign to them. When I lived in the South, and actually I was in groups of Christians that kept more of a Lord's Day and did things like that. But I was real surprised, actually, coming back north after, you know, 14 years or something like that, and find, you know, well, a lot of people go out to eat, go shopping. It's the biggest grocery shopping day of the week, you know, things like that. So no problem with most Christians. But I was reading Adam Clark and some of these older commentators saying, you know, absolutely don't think this is the Sabbath, because that the commandment of the Lord to keep a day special is just inviolable and for all time. So the references here must be to other church holiday, you know, Jewish holidays that were there. But anyway, that's just going backtracking a little bit. Yeah.
Well, isn't Paul kind of throwing, what's that expression when you throw something on the fire and make it?
Throwing gasoline on the fire?
Sort of.
Gasoline hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah,
but.
Except because he designates one group as weak, having weak faith. He does it twice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, clearly, that's why you need an apostle. I'm not going to make those judgments. Verse 1, receive one another. Don't despise in verse 3, right? The idea isn't that let everyone be fully convinced in his own mind, that it's a question of acceptance. The real problem here is judgment. And not just judgment that is kind of the discernment of what I want to practice or what I believe to be true, but what that judgment is turning into, which is contempt for other believers who are right there in the congregation. And, you know, in a sense, a responsible judgment in just terms of decision or view can be kept to yourself. Well, you know how that goes, though. When somebody's judging you and judging you unkindly, and keeping it to themselves, do you know it right away? Oh, I do. I mean, they keep it to themselves. I know I'm being judged by that person. I mean, I can feel it. It's palpable, isn't it? I mean, maybe some people hide it pretty well, but who knows, maybe it's worse than I thought. But I go around, Chris, don't you think people hide it? Oh, I don't take offense, but I sense I've known people who say accept you, but not quite. There's something in their body language or something about the way they relate to you. Think they don't really they don't like me much, or what I do, or what I say, or what I think. Yeah, but it'd be wrong, of course, to read into things. I mean, to be shallow. But I think people when I judge people probably sense it. I'm not quite approving. I don't quite laugh at their jokes. Or maybe you overcompensate, that sort of reaction formation. When somebody's being really nice to you, you think, what are they really thinking that they're being that? You know, everything I do is wonderful to this person. I mean, like, Vicky knows me pretty well and loves me, but she knows everything I do isn't wonderful, you know? Everything I say isn't brilliant. I don't know. I think we know it. Well, what does it mean to judge somebody? Yeah, whatever they're doing, yeah, a judgment is whatever they are doing is wrong. It's inferior, and the implication is that it's you are not contaminated with the same problem. It's their problem, not yours. I mean, that's really a judgment.
Did you say it has more to do with attacking the person rather than the thing? Because
Yeah, to... Yeah, well, I think he's looking out for the church and being able to diagnose what the real issue is. A real church is full of righteousness, joy, and peace, not of eating and drinking, and that you can have this in the Holy Spirit.
But in defense of the Jewish believers who were having trouble with the whole kosher thing, A, they were brought up with that, so there's a very deep level of revulsion. B, if you bring your non-kosher meat to the fellowship meal, that contaminates me. So, I mean, I understand. And I think it's a fear of contamination. I don't think it's just judging, but it's actually a fear that you will be less righteous if you're contaminated by what this person is doing.
And how is that not a judgment, though?
It is a judgment, but I think it's very hard to draw straight lines between the things.
But isn't that how the super righteous always justify judgment, is that this is a dangerous contaminant that will, you know, you'll get it on me. It'll somehow pollute the whole world.
I'm not defending that. I'm just saying, I think it's very hard to do.
Oh, let me never say something's easy to do here. What?
I think one thing that's interesting to me is when you start reading this, you're assuming that you're looking down on those who are, or they were looking down on those who were weak in the faith by those who were new believers, who hadn't learned the truth yet. And really, it says, the one who would only eat the vegetables was the one who was weak in their faith because they were living by that structure.
Isn't that the fascinating thing about it? That it implies, although it doesn't say it directly, that the weak party here that Paul first addresses, the one who is weak in faith, is perhaps the rigorous party, not the new party. I want to get back to this idea. What is the pain in judgment, in being judged? Face it, this is a deep pathology in most congregations. I mean, people sense a judgmental spirit in lots of more rigorous Christians. It drives them away from fellowship. And so you want to diagnose, what is this problem we have that we get in our car when we go home from church on Sunday and we instantly start a litany of judgment? Look, I don't have bugs in your car or anything like that to tell you, but I've been around Christians and ridden home with enough of them to know that it has to start almost instantly. What is the pain in judgment? What does it feel like to be judged?
It's a lack of love.
You don't feel accepted. You feel despised, don't you? Mm-hmm. That's what puts the pain in it. That you are not equal. You're not up to that other person's standard. When we look at this, we see that what is happening through the spirit of judgment in this passage. In verse 1, disputing, arguing over doubtful matters. That's a painful thing. In verse 3, we see a mention of despising. In verse 4, we simply use the term judging again. In verse 10, we use the word judging again. In verse 13, we use the word judging again. Quit doing it. Quit doing it. Quit doing it seems to be the thing that Paul is bringing on us here. Right? Do you see all that? Verse 1, disputing. Verse 3, despising. Verse 4, you judge. Who are you to judge another servant? They will stand. This is a very important lesson. Have confidence. The Lord is at work in another life. He doesn't need you in there tightening the screws and battening down the hatches for him. That person's already accepted by God. In verse 10, you have, why do you judge your brother? Why do you show contempt for him? In verse 13,